Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And I've got a great episode for you today. I sit down with musician Hamish Hawke and it's a delightful chat and I can't wait for you to hear it. But before we kick off with that chat, just a few thank yous. Firstly, a huge thank you to you lot for just being bloody lovely and continuing to listen and send little messages that, you know, what episodes you enjoyed and stuff, and just being generally lovely. So thank you, a huge thanks, because, you know, I'm so blessed to get to have some ace chats with so many, like, you know, amazing creative people, and then to know that other people get enjoyment out of listening to them chats is amazing. So yeah, huge thanks to you lot. Big thanks to the Podfather himself, my homie Scroobius Pip. So thanks loads, Pip, for letting me be part of your Distraction Pieces network. What a lovely place that is. So many other amazing podcasts on there. Films We Buried with Emmy Award winning Brett Goldstein, which is a great podcast. Obviously, my Hardcore Listening podcast is over there with my cohort Chris Glasson. And you've got there's stacks of podcasts over there. Mama Mama, Say Why to Drugs. Gosh, what else? Dan Lesak's got a podcast over there, Scroob Sidekick, and former guest on this. Jason Reed, Stop and Search, it's a great podcast. I'm forgetting some. Bozzers has got a podcast over there. Go check that out if you love your wrestling. I think that's it. Oh, God, I guarantee I forgot someone. But, yeah, go check out the Distraction. Oh, Scroobius Pip's got a podcast on there. I've heard it's all right. So go check out the Distraction Pieces Network. As well as that, big thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. All right. Anyway, just... again, before we get on with the chat, if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then when you get to the end of this delightful chat with Hamish, go check out the back catalogue, because if you like incredible Scottish musicians, listen to my chats with, I've spoke to members of Primal Scream, who else have I had on? Charlene Spiteri of Texas, Carl of The View, both Fran and Dougie of Travis. Who else? I'm sure there's some more. And they're all wonderful chats. So, if Scots musicians are what you're after. And also, one of the most important people in music, Alan McGee. Go and check out my episode of Alan McGee. That's a great chat. And aside from that, Fatboy Slim, Motley Crue, Foo Fighters, Suede, Idol, Sleaford Mods. Oh, the list is endless. Go have a good old rummage and see Deftones. And yeah, producers like Butch Vig, comedians, Jade Adams, Maisie Adam, James Acaster, Ed Gamble. I've heard they've got a podcast. That's meant to be all right, you know. Actors, Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoose, Michael Smiley, Amanda Abington. I've been so lucky to have had these chats about the thing I'm most passionate about, which is music. I get to chat about their lives and the records that have been really important in it. And you're about to get some of that now. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track Podcast with the wonderful Hamish Hawke. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now. And you may have heard me talking about the products from the cacao bar. And there's gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to. And all you've got to do is just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stew Whippin. Hold this. Let me press record. Let's get this on the film. I'm going to press record if that's cool with you.
It's just one of those things. I was asking myself, you know, how cool do I really want to come across? And in the end, I was like, you know what? No, not cool at all. I will just go like fully. Yeah, it's 100% genuine, these choices. So there you go.
Honesty's the best policy. And Hamish, thanks loads for doing this today. I really appreciate it. And it's so true. I mean, when you get to that, I mean, we'll get onto it later. Like, you know, the first record you bought, nobody was buying Pill Sessions like when they were 7 years old. It wasn't happening. No. And I think it was the second ever episode I'd done, or second or third. I had Russell from Block Party on. And he chose some absolutely horrific records, and I just thought, this is amazing. Yeah. This is setting the benchmark. Russell's the guitarist in Block Party. He's, you know, he's a cool guy, and he was just completely honest, and I was like, that's what I want from this podcast. I don't want people coming on going, oh, yeah, I was listening to that when I was nine.
Oh, no, you wasn't. Oh, well, thank goodness. I'm glad that benchmark has been set, because that was the thing. Though, I must say, it's a difficult thing for me, like, because Right, so I'm quite, I like lists. I like making lists. I always have since I was a kid. And I think, you know, my brother always says to me that as a child, I was very curious. And I was always asking him what his favourite something was. I think there was something about that word, favourite, that I just liked. That, like, the number one, you know, the kind of high fidelity top five. I really thought that defined people. And I got really, really into asking people that. But then as I grew older, I realised people don't have those exactly. And they're certainly not, like, static, you know. But the doing
this... Hamish, you need to come on my other podcast.
Oh, please, please.
So my other podcast is called Hardcore Listing. And that's my longest running podcast. And that is purely based on high fidelity and my obsession with lists, where you pick a subject, whether it be sandwiches, B-sides, whatever, and then you have to do the definitive top five.
You're a man after my own heart, right? It's a day. I'm there.
But nobody was choosing music on it. That was the thing. So I had to set this one up alongside it so I could be the music nerd that I am.
Okay.
Well, we always like to start things with track one, and I'm going to ask you, please, Hamish, to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, this one took me a little while, but then as soon as this song came to mind, it was like, oh, it's absolutely unquestionable, for me anyway. And it's All Along the Watchtower by the Jimi Hendrix Experience. You know that song from a million miles away as soon as you hear that introduction, and it's just, I mean... it's pure magic, that intro, and that song generally. And to be quite frank, the career of Jimi Hendrix is a bit like that. I would say Jimi Hendrix was the first musical icon that I think I was an obsessive about. Jimi Hendrix, well, for me anyway, was like, you know, when maybe when you're sort of 15, 16, and you want to appear quite highbrow, and you maybe get into art or something, and people have like Salvador Dali on the walls, you know, that kind of thing. I think Jimi Hendrix was that, you know, like, oh, I'm into music. Oh, yeah, well, do you like Jimi Hendrix? You know, like, yeah, have you heard this song called purple haze. Yeah, that's pretty cool, pretty niche, right? So Jimi Hendrix was the first icon that I was truly obsessed with, but it came with a price because, and I remember so vividly, it got to the point where I'd told so many people that I was obsessed with Jimi Hendrix and that he was the greatest and all of this stuff. And then every birthday and Christmas, everything was Jimi Hendrix, biographies, you know, and I was still quite young and I didn't have that much time to be like dealing with these like numerous hardback biographies of Jimi Hendrix and posters absolutely covered. And there isn't that much material to dig into, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So in the end, it kind of, I think I oversaturated it very early on. But that intro is just unquestionable. It's just, yeah, as I say, it's just magic. Like, I couldn't think. There were a few contenders on my.
Oh, go on. Well, you're allowed honorable mentions.
I really like the beginning of Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, and it has a similar thing. It hits you like a ton of bricks. You know, it just comes at you like a runaway train, and it couldn't be any other song. But that intro of All Along the Watchtower, and it has that, you know, it has that sort of, I don't know what it is that gets struck, but it's a very, very, and obviously the just the, you know, the music, the musicianship behind everything that Jimi Hendrix experience did, you know, like Mitch Mitchell on the drums and stuff, is just unparalleled, really. So as soon as I thought of that, I was like, got it, first one down.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, Jimi Hendrix has been, Watchtower hasn't been chosen. I think Voodoo Child's been chosen twice.
Yeah.
That is a good one as well.
Oh, yeah, really good.
Yeah. But he was no stranger to a good, I mean, Foxy Lady, I mean, Crosstown Traffic. What an intro that is.
I know. And there's Highway Child, that's got a good one.
Yeah.
And even Little Wing, that's got a nice.
Yeah.
And I remember a friend of mine at school, high school, friend of mine, Josh. He was saying, we were waxing lyrical about Jimi Hendrix as we, you know, at the age of 14, as if we were like aficionados and the only ones who'd ever heard of Jimi Hendrix. And he said, I remember him saying it in geography. He said that the first lyrics of Little Wing, he thought were the coolest lyrics of of any song, the coolest first lyrics of any song, which is, okay, well, she's walking. And I was like, oh yeah, that is quite good. You know, well, she's walking. You know, I thought,
profound.
Yeah, just very suave, you know. But I also, my sister, back when I was that kind of age, 15, 16, she was going out with a guy who was a really, really good guitarist. And I, you know, to try and appear cool in front of him, I was trying to get him into talking about Jimi Hendrix. And I was talking about Voodoo Child. And I think I was doing an impression of the wah-wah sound of the guitar. And I was doing...
How did that work out for you?
Really not well. Not well at all. And in fact, it just got worse and worse. Because I said, you know, brown, brown, and it doesn't go brown, it goes wow. You know, and I was saying,
so specific.
Because I thought I was quite good at mimicking the sound of the guitar. But he said it goes wow, not wow. I said, okay, fine. And then I think this was when I was learning to play the guitar as well. And he said, and I said, oh, I remember he had this cool, this little electric guitar, which ended up being my first electric guitar, and he sort of gifted it to me. And I remember it had been in his, you know, student flat, and it was, you know, like fag ash all over it and all that kind of stuff. And I said, it's terrible. I said, how do you clean the guitar? And he said, I don't clean my guitar. I was like, oh no, now I'm this kid who can't impersonate a wah-wah pedal who polishes his guitar all the time. It's like, terrible. So anyway, so that's the journey of Jimi Hendrix experience, the Jimi Hendrix experience and
wonderful.
Me. But yeah, there you go.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to start to go back a little bit. And for track two, I'm going to ask you, please, to tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Yeah, this one, well, the first song that came to mind, and I decided to just stick with the first one, was Father and Son by Cat Stevens. So I grew up in quite a musical household, in as much as there was a lot of music. You know, my parents were big music fans, as was my brother and as was my sister. No one in the family was particularly musical in terms of playing instruments around the house. That wasn't a big thing in my family. But my dad was into the Stones and the Animals and Bob Dylan and all of the, I would say the sort of classic 60s and 70s rock and roll. Well, not rock and roll, but rock bands, you know. Eric Burdon and all that. And my mum, well, my sister was into Britpop. She was that age, so it was all Oasis, Blur, Pulp, along with some other bits and bobs. My brother, sort of skater punk, so kind of like Less Than Jake and Pennywise and sort of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater soundtrack kind of stuff. And my mum was into folky singer-songwriters. So it was all James Taylor, Ralph McTell, Cat Stevens, Leonard Cohen, and even, you know, things like Kris Kristofferson and John Denver and that sort of thing.
That's a lovely hybrid of music to be exposed to.
This is what I was going to say, is that felt very ordinary to me at the time. But now when I look back on it, and now when I talk to my parents about it, it's actually quite eclectic. You know, I was the sort of blank slate on which all of that was put. And it really is quite sort of multifaceted, I suppose. But I think it was my mum's music taste. So it was all these, I suppose, singer-songwriters, lyricists. It was all these people who could tell stories in songs. But every so often there was a crossover. And I remember Tea for the Tillerman by Cat Stevens a lot when I was growing up. I remember thinking, Where Do the Children Play, the track one, that I thought his voice was incredible and got really, really low and nice. And I still know that album so, so well and still get real pangs of nostalgia whenever I listen to it. But Father and Son, to this day, it remains true, I get very emotional when it comes to songs written either by kids about their parents or from parents, you know, from the perspective of parents about their kids. And there was something about Father and Son. It's actually, I mean, whenever I listen to it now, I'm dumbfounded. It's so cleverly done because it appears effortless, but it's this kind of, he was, you know, Cat Stevens was still young when he wrote it, and he was trying to write from the perspective of an older father to his son. And it comes across as incredibly worldly wise, in my mind anyway. And it still really touches me. And when I was at, primary school and sort of early high school, if I would ever come home slightly down about something, whenever, you know, whether if something was too, it was all too much, or something had gone wrong with a friend of mine, or like a bully or something like that, my dad had a habit of taking me out for a drive or for like a run in the car, just like, you know, for 15 minutes around the block or whatever. And I always think about the lyric from Kooks by David Bowie on Hunky Dory, where he says, "And if the homework brings you down, then we'll throw it on the fire and take the car downtown," right? And that's kind of what it was. And oddly enough, I remember listening to that song in the car on those evenings. But Father and Son, it always, even then, I thought it was a very clever song, but it wasn't overtly clever, and it wasn't trying to do anything fancy. It was actually really, really simple, but the melody is also beautiful, and it's got lovely sort of ebbs and flows. And I remember being really affected by that even when I was young. And, you know, as much as, you know, my dad also liked Leonard Cohen, and I, you know, would sort of get further into that later in life, I actually, nothing quite spoke to me as much as something like Cat Stevens that was quite plain speaking early on, you know?
Yeah. Just making me think about songs from like parents to children, and I'm going to give you a couple that if you haven't heard, do tell me if you have heard them, that will break you in half. Have you heard Brickbat by Billy Bragg?
No, I don't. No. Right, I'm writing it down immediately. Hopefully, fans listening won't judge and say, "For God's sake!"
No, it was a latter bit of Billy. It's not kind of, you know, premium era Billy, I guess. There's a beautiful line in there about how he used to want to plant bombs at the last night of the proms, and now you're finding me the baby with the big shell at the bath time, listening for the sound of the sea. It's really lovely. Right. And there's another one called "Still Fighting It" by Ben Folds.
Oh no, I don't know that, but I do like Ben Folds. Still fighting it. What do you don't know what album that's on, do you?
One with Suburbs. The first solo album, I think.
Still fighting it. Right, I've written those both down. Excellent.
Yeah, it weren't Ben Folds 5. It was Ben Folds.
I was going to say, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's a beauty. That is.
Okay. Cool. Thank you very much. Great.
Enjoy. Yeah,
well, oddly enough, doing this, compiling this list, you know, because actually, oddly enough, there's a, well, in some of the choices or some of the potential choices I had, there was actually something of a theme forming. There were variations on that particular theme. So,
Really?
Yeah, so maybe it's time for me to really go knee deep in that and, I don't know, make a list or a playlist or something, you know. Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Incredible.
There we go.
Right. Cool. So, for track 3, I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Okay, so there were a few competitors for this one.
Okay, sure.
Well, but I'm going to pick one. Right, so from the age of about 14, I was going to gigs locally pretty much every weekend.
Is this in Edinburgh?
Yeah. And shout out to my friend Peggy. Hi, Peggy, if you're listening. I would meet Peggy and I, along with her older brother, would go to gigs all the time. He was a huge music fan, and we were sort of through him indirectly, and we would go to the gigs so frequently. I remember back then it was all right if you were that age to bring along to the door of the gig a photocopy of your passport, because you could say to the bouncer, I am but a child, my mum doesn't want me out with a valuable document like a passport, so I have this photocopy. And so we were also of the generation where we were like, maybe we can do something here. So we moved on like Photoshop or like Microsoft Paint or whatever it was, moved numbers from like the passport number into the date of birth. So we were a couple of years older, because if you're under 14, you couldn't get in without an adult or something. So between the ages of 14 and 16, we would do that, and then after we were 16 we could start going on our own, right? But this was in Edinburgh and in Glasgow. So from that period of time, there's a huge number of songs and a huge number of bands, a lot of whom have completely disappeared into the ether. But a lot of bands. But there's one song in particular, which is actually slightly later. So it's like maybe when I was about 16, 17, that I just associate with school altogether, which is The Modern Leper by Frightened Rabbit. I've said before, in fact, that album, if you were sort of 16, 17 in 2008 or whenever it was, that was the album. There was a band, they were Frightened Rabbit, there was an album, and it was The Midnight Organ Fight. And it was like it was like an explosion onto the scene. And it was played at parties, huge sing-alongs, particularly of young guys, as you can imagine, screaming at the top of their lungs every lyric. And it was also, you know, as much as there were, you know, a lot of bands I was into had a sort of lyrical focus in some sense, Frightened Rabbit was the first that was delivered in a purely Scots brogue, and had this slightly adolescent relevance. I think it was a lot about, you know, getting drunk and the sort of violence of like early romantic relationships, that kind of like onslaught of lust and hormones, and it all just, you know, you didn't know how to control it. And we were all living that experience, you know, at the time, and we were all, you know, we're all underage and drunk at these parties. And I remember the lyrics being the first lyric of that song is, "A cripple walks amongst you all, you tired human beings," and delivered in this, as I say, he was from Selkirk, if I'm not mistaken. So it's really this particular accent that I'd never heard in music before. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, this is for us. This is about us.
Yeah.
And the song was ours. And it just, you know, as I say, I'd been into lots of bands, say, you know, like Scottish bands in particular, whether it was, you know, Franz Ferdinand, someone like that. It's like they happened to be Scottish, but their songs weren't Scottish by definition. They were far, you know, wider than that. Frightened Rabbit, although never parochial in any sense, really felt local. And then the references just expanded throughout the album, obviously, to places that we knew. And situations that we recognised, and talked about Kaylee dancing and all that stuff. And that was really, really something. And to this day, I need to pay homage to Frightened Rabbit and to Scott Hutcherson, or to the memory of Scott Hutcherson, because without that album, it was just absolutely fundamental to me wanting to become a songwriter. It was absolutely fundamental. And I covered songs from that record in some of my first ever performances, and I still, whenever I listen to it, I just, as I say, I know every corner of it, and everyone my age in this part of the country did, and that's nothing to be sniffed at, you know. So
incredible band, absolutely incredible.
Really
band.
Are.
It's really interesting that you say that. You know, it felt, you know, good to hear somebody singing how you talk about. I mentioned Billy Bragg earlier. That's very much how I felt when I heard Billy Bragg sing. Yeah. But I watched a documentary that was on BBC maybe sort of 2-3 years ago about Scottish music. Mm. I don't know if you saw it.
I don't think so.
And they sort of talked about the kind of boom in the late 80s of Wet, Wet, mm-hmm. Wet, Deacon mm-hmm. Blue, Hue and Cry, and all of them, Texas, and these bands. Yeah. And kind of, they were all huge bands, but didn't necessarily sing with Scottish accents.
No.
Then they threw the Proclaimers in the mix.
yeah.
And was like, but then this comes along. And I don't know if you watched because not long after that on BBC, they put the Proclaimers documentary on, which was a masterpiece.
I haven't seen it, but I have heard phenomenal things about that documentary. Lots of people
glorious.
Spoke to me about that. And the Proclaimers, I'm from Edinburgh. I mean, goodness. You live and breathe the Proclaimers, but they're so underrated. It's unbelievable, and you know, they're defined by 500 miles and so on. The breadth of their repertoire is really something, and the social commentary as well. is
bang on.
Yeah, it's so sharp and wonderfully observed. I've got a real, real soft spot for the Proclaimers.
So do you know how they kind of made it? How they kind of got exposure? Who found them and how it got passed about?
No, I don't think I do, but please tell me.
I hope I get this right, but these two characters were definitely key to it. Kevin Rowland of Dexys heard it, demo, and was like, fuck, what is this? And I can't think what tracks. I think Letter to America was on it.
Great song.
And I can't think what other track was on it. And it blew Kevin Rowland's mind. And I believe he then recorded some of their first demos and went, I need to get this band on the road. Who will get it? Sent it to Paul Heaton, who went, fuck, we're taking these on tour with the House Martins. And then that was where it went from there. Like, I mean, if you've got Kevin Rowland and Paul Heaton shouting your corner, you're going to do all right,
totally.
Aren't you?
Yeah, I knew Paul Heaton was a fan. Oh, Kevin Rowland, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, apparently so. Apparently so.
I love it because they just don't fit in any box at all. They don't fit in any pigeonhole that you want to put them in. And I massively rate them for that reason, you know. And actually, oddly enough, it's something that, you know, I don't want to generalise too much, but it's something that I've heard said of quite a few Edinburgh bands in particular. It's just a sort of, you know, it spans quite a few genres and we don't exactly know how to describe it, how to sell it, who's going to like it, you know. And Edinburgh feels, as a music scene anyway, something of an outlier in Scotland because, and I would say in the UK generally, is that Glasgow is the hub. You know, if you're a Glasgow band, that's already a thing. You know, it's like you can, whether it's Glasgow art school bands or punk bands or whatever it might be, you can, there are those touchstones already. You can go, oh yeah, that's, they're with them. You know, it's like, oh well, course, okay, yeah. Glasgow art school. All right, so it's sort of Orange Juice or like a bit later, like Bell and Sebastian, Camera Obscura, like whatever it might be. But Edinburgh doesn't have that. People go, where are these guys from? You know, like, what is this? And the Proclaimers especially, to get a duo, you know, it's just, And truest songwriters, they're brilliant.
Yeah. No image required, styling.
It's just massive respect.
Shirt and a pair of jeans.
Yeah. And if you live in Edinburgh, you see the Proclaimers about. Or at least you see...
Really?
Yeah, totally. You see them walking around. Or you see one of them walking around. And you always... Oh, Proclaimer. There's a Proclaimer. Always, yeah. It's just they're one of the...
Wow.
Yeah, there's a few famous faces in Edinburgh, I would say. But yeah, a Proclaimer... Mm. Yeah, it's like an Edinburgh bingo, you know.
Oh, dear. Right, well, before we get on to the next fact, let's talk school. Was it something you enjoyed?
Yes, I did. I think that's embarrassing to say these days.
No, not at all. I
did enjoy school. It's funny, I think I was a kind of middling performer at school. I was like, you know, I always did all right in exams. I did my homework. I wasn't a swot. And I thought, that's, I mean, maybe, is that fair to say these days? I wasn't a swot. I wasn't a teacher's pet. But, you know, keeping that alive from school, you know, I wasn't one of them.
Yeah.
I wasn't in the front row. But
swot is massively underused.
Yeah,
let's bring
SWAT,
that back.
Yeah, like swot. So I wasn't a swot, but I wasn't an... you couldn't say I was an underachiever. I couldn't say that. But I really enjoyed
an in-betweener.
An in-betweener, yeah. But I loved all of my memories from school are all of my pals. And it was all the things that happened after school, or the conversations in class, or the walks between class, or, you know, things that happen at break or lunch, or, you know, even in, you know, the last couple of years of school, like, oh, what things going on in the common room? You know, it was always about socializing and having fun. And not, you know, I think there's quite a few people who know what I'm talking about. It's that there were the class clowns who teachers kind of actually didn't like. They were like, these people are annoying, and they're sort of vying for attention all the time. But then there were people that probably, you know, they could be called class clowns, but the teachers had a bit of a twinkle in their eye for them. You know, oh, OK, he's a bit of a thorn in my side, but go on, he's all right. I think I was definitely that. And I definitely got other people in trouble. I remember yeah. I was sitting beside a friend of mine and I was talking. I was clearly the one talking. And then the teacher shouted at her, sort of, oh, you know, well, for goodness sake, could you stop talking over? You're so arrogant. It was so clearly me, but I got nothing happened to me. So I was a bit...
Obviously, you as a gentleman and put your hand up and said, actually, it was me, yes. Or did you just throw her under the bus?
I wish I could say I did that, but of course I didn't do that. I mean, God, that would be insane. So, I wasn't exactly a class clown, but I was definitely a... a joker, I suppose. Chancer? Maybe not a chancer. I didn't get in too much trouble. But
Was you confident?
Yeah, definitely. And
did you like attention?
Yeah. Though I feel that school, I was a bit... It would be later that I came into my own. I was confident, but... Yeah, it was maybe when I was about 17 or, yes, last couple of years of school, I was finally like, I know who I am, this is what it is. And yeah, by the end, it was walking around the common room. I was a bit of a social butterfly. I was able to be in lots of different groups. And over time, I think, yeah, I'd developed lots of a sort of wide social circle. I never like excluded people or anything. You know, I just wanted all the friends I could get. And school for me was very much about the social life of school. But I did, I studied, I mean, I really enjoyed English. I was really fortunate. I was fortunate enough to have lots of teachers I liked. Really, really good teachers. And I think that's half the battle with school. You know, I mean, if you have good teachers, they can inspire you for the rest of your life. People don't forget teachers. People still talk about them when they're, you know, 30, 40, 50. You know, like they always, oh, yeah, I remember Mrs. Blah, or I remember Miss So-and-so or Mr. Blah, blah, and he said this and whatever, and he got me into this. You know, that's you can't beat that. And I had so many great teachers. I had a wonderful set of English teachers. I did German. I really, really enjoyed languages. So I did German, really enjoyed that. And I did drama. And that was, we had a great drama department in the school. And I feel very fortunate for my school experience. And I carry it with me, I think, to this day, really.
Did you know what you wanted to be when you was at school?
No. I think I knew, you know, I think I was a... I was a bit of a jack of all trades. I think I wanted, it was more about, well, you know, if I'm good at this, maybe I could do that. Or like, you know, I went to university to do German. And then as soon as I arrived, kind of switched instantly because I'd found something else I liked. But then once I started studying that, I was busy doing recreational stuff, all the extracurricular music stuff. And that's when I started writing songs proper and performing. And I always knew that I wanted to do something on a stage. I really, really liked performing and felt that was kind of a necessity for moving forward, moving toward what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That was where that was the direction of my ambition, really, even at school.
Yeah.
But, because I enjoyed the social part of school, I generally liked being in class because it was just like, oh, who am I sitting next to in this class again? Oh, yeah, okay, cool. So, I didn't know exactly, but as I say, it sort of fell into place. And yeah, it was like, oh yeah, this is definitely what I meant to be doing, you know. So
for track 4,
yes,
I'd like you to tell me the first song you remember buying, whether that's a cassette, a CD, or whatever format it was from a record store.
Well, so my motivation behind this, the answer to this question, was that I remember, you know, we were talking earlier, people always have these really cool albums that they bought as their first album. And weirdly enough, I bought 3 albums on the same day. And I remember,
okay.
So these are the ones I've given you, but because I'll explain that in a second. But I bought three albums on the same day. I was with my parents. We went down to visit family friends down south. And I bought three albums, and they were the first albums that I chose. I bought them with my own money. It was purely of my own volition. And I know that I was sort of, I think even then I was trying to buy the right things. So it's kind of like I had that in mind as I was buying them. Sort of, okay, well, what CDs am I going to look like I'm going to be into? And I bought three. I bought one, which was Franz Ferdinand's self-titled debut album. I bought Aha, Shake Heartbreak by Kings of Leon, because my brother had played four kicks from that album to me, and I thought that was great. And I bought Up the Bracket by the Libertines, because I'd heard Time for Heroes, which is right mm-hmm. in the middle of that album. And so those were the first three albums I bought for myself.
I mean, you've ticked three cool boxes there, right?
It's quite good, isn't it? It is quite good.
Yeah.
I mean, and also I remember being given at a similar time, Elephant by the White Stripes. My brother bought me that as a CD. So right. Those are four pretty good ones. But your question was song. Which song do you remember buying? Mm. And I have two. So the first ever gig I went to, really, was an in-store gig in FOP on Rose Street in Edinburgh. And it was by Sons and Daughters, the Glasgow band Sons and Daughters, who I still love. Once again, huge pangs of nostalgia when I listened to their first couple of albums. And I was front row right there, you know, and I was learning how to be at gigs, which was, you know, when they drop the plectrum, pick it up. when they walk away and they have the sheet of paper there with the songs on it, pick it up. And when you go over to them, take that piece of paper and put it in front of them and say, sign it. You know, so they were releasing their second album, The Repulsion Box, and they were playing a series of in-stores. And I bought their single from that, which is called Dance Me In, which that's the first CD single I bought.
Has that got a cover of Adamski's Killer on the flip side?
What, on the single, on the album?
On the CD single.
I think if I remember it correctly, it's like block white letters, Sons and Daughters, all caps.
Yep.
And then Repulsion Box, block red letters, all caps.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of, maybe I haven't looked too closely at it, like a lady's arm with some flowers and a mesh of hair and something like that.
I'm sure I have that, and I'm sure that track two is a cover of Adamski's Killer. I might be wrong, but I'm sure I'm right.
Well, there you go.
Again, like, you're just repping cool tunes here.
That's good. So that was the CD single. The one after that, which was the first ever 7-inch vinyl I ever bought, which was 99p, I remember that.
Yeah.
Avalanche Records, Coburn Street, Edinburgh. Paolo Nutini was doing an in-store, and I had never heard of him because this was either his first single or his second single. And you were on the cusp of the big time, but it wasn't really until like the next record where it was really mad. After like Jetty, Don't Be Hasty and all that, it was like Sunny Side Up. Mm. Those were the big ones, Candy and stuff. But went to the in-store, and Peggy, once again, hi Peggy, she said, there's this guy playing at Avalanche, do you want to come? I said, absolutely. Went, and it was just wall-to-wall early teenage girls and me. And he played, and he was really good, to be fair. It was really, really good. And obviously, I didn't, you know, he just had these singles at the time. So I bought the single. I was like, 99p, fine. Queued up, got it signed. Well, got queuing up to get it signed. And I remember, if you're listening, Paolo, he said, oh, what's your name? I said, oh, Hamish. And he wrote that. And then he started writing Love, L-O, and he wrote, oh, you're a guy. And then wrote to him, low down. And then Paolo Nutini. So, I was like, come on. was like, it's all right. I don't think you're in love with me. It's fine.
Oh my God.
I still have that 7-inch, which is last request by Paolo Nutini. 7-inch single, low down, Paolo Nutini. So,
Jesus Christ.
Don't think... Weird thing, though, because I only thought about this a couple of years ago. The B-side to that is the song Sugar Man by Rodriguez, a cover of that.
Okay.
And you know that documentary, that Searching for Sugar Man? That was like, you know, 10 years after that. So I thought... I don't know much about exact... I've heard the things about that documentary and how actually it was far more known than that documentary makes out and so on. But
that track, that track come to fruition probably around 2000. Just the Sugar Man track.
Right, okay.
Because I knew nothing else. I mean, obviously since watching that documentary, Cold Facts up there. It was one of my favourite records. The Sugar Man track was used by, was it David Holmes? On a David Holmes record. He'd done like a kind of like a mixtape release, and that track was on there. So I used to play it in the clubs then, but I'd heard nothing else of him. And I think maybe that track being on there was maybe what got...
The song had done
Sugar Man was.
But even then, I did look at it and thought, that's quite... interesting, and it's perfect for Paolo Nutini's voice as well. So really, at the time didn't have a record player, so I bought it as a vehicle for the signature, was what it was. And then it wasn't until years later that I actually played it. So that was first ever 7-inch single. So those are the first songs, Sons and Daughters, Paolo Nutini.
I mean, all very credible,
Thank
Hamish.
You.
All very
Thank
cool.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Right, you told me, first of all, that you weren't into clubbing, because for track five, I'd like to ask you the song that soundtracked you as clubbing. So I need to kind of point out that I always worry that people kind of can sometimes misconstrue this as shirt off, lost summer in Ibiza, glow sticks. Yeah. Like, this can be going down the local indie club and throwing yourself around the Libertines.
Right, okay.
So if that was clubbing...
Okay. Well, okay.
What was your sort of social habits then when you got to sort of 17, 18, when everyone was there local? There must have been around that time, if like Franz and Libs,
well,
right? That must
have
been indie heaven.
Yeah, I mean, Franz is a very, very good show. My social habits, it was parties, you know. I had a friend of mine who had a basement in his house, and we had a very sort of close circle of friends, and we'd always go round to that basement and do terrible things. but we used to go round to that basement, and he had, you know, it wasn't that he had over, you know, not particularly lenient parents or anything like that, but his dad was sort of up for us safely using that space to go, okay, well, if you're gonna, you know, that classic, if you're gonna drink, if you're gonna do that, I'd prefer you to do it here, which was great for us, you know. And it was on the other side of town from where I stayed, so it was the kind of place where I could easily, you know, like crash that night and things and not worry about getting home and things. Franz Ferdinand is a very, very good one, because songs like Take Me Out, Dark of the Matinee, Michael. I mean, I remember Michael being one of the first riffs I could ever play on the guitar. That was huge. And those songs, we knew so, so well. And in fact, actually, I have to be honest and say, it's actually, despite having known their first album very, very well, that second lead single, Do You Wanna? That was ridiculously huge for my group of friends generally. And that would always come on. It's difficult, I must admit, it's difficult not to bring in Mr. Brightside by The Killers, because it's...
Tell me your thoughts on that. Not The Killers, that track.
On Mr. Brightside?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Is this a test? Are you...
No, because...
I think it's great. First of all, it's a irrevocable classic now. And probably up there with that with probably there's not many stone cold classics from that era. I can't think off the top of my head right now a song even close to as big as that song really is.
I would say from that era, the other close runners would be Take Me Out, probably.
Yeah, yeah. Like, maybe I Bet You Look Good in the Dance Floor by Arctic Monkeys. Yeah. That's pretty big. And that was another one that was played at parties. I remember going to see the Arctic Monkeys. And this is, I often remind myself of this because it sounds so long ago. I remember going to see the Arctic Monkeys at a NME... what was it? The NME Shockwaves Awards Tour.
Yeah.
And they played all over the UK. And it was a four band bill. It was started with the Mystery Jets.
Mm-hmm. What a band.
We Are Scientists. Then yep. Arctic Monkeys. And then Maximo Park. And I remember Arctic mm-hmm. Monkeys were third on the bill. Because now, obviously, they would be naturally the headline there. But they were third on the bill, and they were just reaching that MySpace fame level. But they played in the Corn Exchange here in Edinburgh, and it must have been either the week that single came out,
wow,
or the following week or something, and it was carnage. Absolute
yeah.
carnage. And I remember I was front row, and it's all these lads in tracksuits, you know. And it was just, yeah, that was next level. I'd never seen, because the thing was, my friend that I went with, she said, you have to learn the words before we go. I have to? You know, I was like, okay. And then I realized when I arrived, I was like, oh yeah, I totally have to. Because you know, like, otherwise I would have looked like this lemon standing there, like, who's this guy who doesn't yeah. know the words? To go back to your question, yeah, things like, yeah, Franz Ferdinand, Arctic Monkeys. But yeah, Killers, I mean, that was, and it remains to this day, it's the end of the night song, isn't it? It's the wedding, it's the wedding song. You know, it's like people play at the end of the night at weddings.
They played it at the end of my daughter's prom.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know. It's a great song. I'm not going to dispute that. I actually think
it's a perfect pop song.
And in fact, Hot Fuss generally is yeah. really quite an achievement, I think, as far as early noughties indie rock goes. It's your bread and butter, really, that album.
I just wish they wouldn't have just been the Simps, because I liked yeah. that little hybrid of... I liked the Pet Shop Boys influence oh, yeah. and all of that. It was yeah, like, yeah. oh, don't become Bruce Springsteen. Stick with yeah, the pop, did, because it really...
They did go a bit heartland, didn't they? I mean, but that's, you know, that's them, isn't it? In fact, that's yes. one of the things that I often think of when I think of those bands that I was going to see, whether they were... You know, there was all, you know, like the Kooks or Hard-Fi or like the Automatic and all that kind of stuff. All that stuff.
I think they call it Landfill Indie now.
I'm glad you said it. Because that's the thing, actually.
It was written all over your face, that word.
But that's the thing. Okay, so I'm sure, and quite rightly, all of those bands, the members of those bands, are going, oh, you know, the bloody cheek, you know, like, we're not Landfill, blah, blah. I don't even mean that in a derogatory way.
No, it's a press term, yeah, isn't it?
It's a press term. It's an NME word. I get it.
Yeah.
But I still hold a lot of those bands close to my heart. And in fact,
completely.
I actually made a playlist not too long ago for a friend of mine, because he made one similar that was the sort of, the cream of the Landfill that was always yeah. like, what would we put these in Landfill? And no, they're too good. You know, it was almost like
yeah.
the Future Heads had a couple of songs like that. It was too good to be Landfill. Maximo Park had a couple. The oh. Zootons. You know, there was a lot of shit, but there was a yeah. lot of good stuff as well. And
was it called Pressure Point?
Pressure Point by the Zootons. Yeah.
Fuck
so
me,
good.
That is
it's such
cracking
it's such
tune
a good riff.
Is,
I mean, it's so good. They yeah. are currently, I hear, recording an album at the moment, the Zootons, in Abbey Road with Nile Rodgers. as the producer, which, so I'm quite excited about that.
I'm sure Dave McCabe can't be struggling with the mortgage.
No, I don't think so. I think ever since Valerie came over, I think he's fine.
100%. 100%. I had Dave Kenning of The Killers on the podcast.
Oh, really? Oh, did you?
And I was like, right, I'm going to ask you what the greatest ever intro is. Are you? Because he wrote Mr. Brightside intro. And I was like, are you going to big your own intro up? He went, that's all right, isn't it? I was like, come on, man.
He had carte blanche just to say. just
100%. I would have been dining out on it all day long.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. Oh, goodness. But there was, as I say, there was a lot of, what I was going to say was one thing that when I was making this landfill, quote unquote, landfill playlist, there were some criteria that the songs had to make. And I tell you why. Well, first of all, it's far too accomplished and far too good and far too popular to ever be considered landfill. But there is a crucial reason why the Killers couldn't be there. And it's because they're American. And landfill is, as far as I'm concerned, is a British genre. It is it's lads, you know, it's like a... Not lads in the Oasis sense. I know what you mean.
Kind of, it was more scallies then, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Boys. So, the ordinary boys. You know, like, boys. Yeah.
Yep.
Usually just your kind of classic setup, guitar, bass, drums, vocal. Maybe a spicy keys in there. But then that's when you start moving towards more of a, like keen... You know, like it's a different vibe altogether.
It's all the K's, mate. It's King, Killers, Kasabian, Kaisers, Kings of Leon, Kooks.
See, this is the thing. Once bands get to a certain height, you know, whether it's Kasabian, whether it's Kaiser Chiefs, landfill doesn't seem to work anymore. It's sort of like a moot point. And that's why I think even Maximo Park, actually, it's like, you know, they transcended the landfill. They left. And they left the landfill floating in the estuary. Yeah, they left. Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Oh, right. I'm going to take you home. Okay. Favorite song from an artist from your home county.
Right. So as we've already discussed.
And I refrained from talking about this band when you spoke about people singing in their own
accent. Yes, well, understandably. Oh. So as we've already discussed, Edinburgh can be quite a limiting... if I were to choose Edinburgh or even the Lothians, I'd be hard-pressed to find... you know, I'd be able to tell you my favourite song, but it would be out of quite a small bunch of songs. And this song actually kind of came to me as a bit of a surprise, but I listened to it again when you'd posed the question. And I loved it.
Ain't it good?
It's so good. And I don't think I've ever really spoken about it with people before. But the song is "It's My Own Cheating Heart That Makes Me Cry" by Glass Vegas. I adore Glass Vegas, particularly that debut, that eponymous debut album. I think it's bloody brilliant. And
you're in good company, Hamish. You're in very good company.
I'm so glad to hear that. It's odd. A few people have said to me, sort of musical pals of mine, have said to me, I can't believe you like that album, right? Which I really, you know, there's some bands and some albums I can perfectly understand why they would say that to me. But with Glass Vegas, I'm like, why would you say that? You know, why? It's got, you know, it's this sort of doo-wop vocal that, you know, influenced, you know, with all the wah-ohs and the wo-wos of the Supremes and the Ronettes and the Shangri-Las, against this kind of Jesus and Mary Chain guitars, which, I mean, oh, it's just bliss, with the most incredible lyrical chops and this vocal that's just like, well, it's just unstoppable. And the honestly, the poetry of James Allen's, I love it. And So I went to see Glass Vegas. And speaking of, and this is kind of where that variations on a theme I was talking about earlier comes in. I went to see Glass Vegas with my brother and my dad. And I, you know, I didn't go to gigs with my dad a lot at the time or anything. They were playing Cabaret Voltaire in Edinburgh. It's a very, very small brick club, really, really one of the smallest. And this was right when they were burgeoning, right when Glass Vegas were really the, you know, because the NME, I remember, really thought, oh, this is the thing. You know, like they're the hot ones at the moment, you know, and they were on the cover and you could tell that they thought, right, this is going to be the start of something massive. And so all the press were behind them. And we went to that gig and we were just crammed in this tiny little brick sweatbox. And I remember thinking it was so great because we were right up to the monitors. And instead of all the lights being on the stage, there were big lamps turned on the audience, shining into the audience, bright red lamps and smoke. And then, you know, the guitarist comes on and just distortion, just into the monitors. It's already like, you know, all kinds of frequencies going on. And and then James Allen comes on, bottle of Buckfast, and just like hands it down into the crowd. And I remember my dad standing there, and it's absolutely deafening. It's really, really loud. And my dad standing there like a statue, like that, like standing straight up there, but absolutely beaming, you know, like beaming, just thrilled to be there. And I remember buying a 7-inch of Flowers and Football Tops and Daddy's Gone at that gig. And I still, that's one of the best gigs I've ever seen, just in terms of the energy in the room. It's one of those completely intangible things. But that, yeah, in particular, It's My Own Cheating Heart That Makes Me Cry. Oh, I can just weep at that song. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, I heard, I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, but I watched an interview with Frank Zappa once, and he said in it to the interviewer, the interviewer had asked him about, you know, what the state of rock and roll or something, or the state of rock music. And he said, I don't make rock music. My music is nothing to do with rock and roll. It just happens to be consumed by a rock and roll audience. And I thought, oh, that's such an astute observation, I thought at the time. And I think Glass Vegas, particularly with that NME hype surrounding them at the time, I think there was this, you know, people thought they were for people who were into Oasis, the Charlatans, the kind of, you know, like that sort of 90s Britpop. And of course, lots of those people do listen to Glass Vegas. But there's this other side to the band that's so much more, and I don't want to, you know, speak ill of those Britpop bands, but it's so much more poetical and so much more emotional and so much more
vulnerable.
It's and the topics that he deals with, and it's incredible that James Allen's able to sort of separate himself from the subject matter, and yet, you know, because it's not often clear whether it's most of the time. In fact, you can tell it's not him he's singing about. It's not autobiographical, but he manages to implant himself right into the center of the subject at hand. And just squeeze all the emotion out of it and make it so real. And so there was that gig I saw of Glass Vegas. I saw them a couple of years later at a festival, and I remember seeing a man of 55 cross-legged in the mud weeping while they were playing Daddy's Gone. I thought, that doesn't happen. You know, it really, really affected me, that. And I still, you know, Daddy's Gone does it to me as well. Flowers and Football Tops as well.
Geraldine. Man.
I mean, these songs, I mean, and even I loved their, they released a Christmas EP, like, the following year that has, about five songs on it. There's another one about, you know, being in a guy in prison and all this stuff and a breakup and all this stuff. But they're heart-wrenching. They're absolutely heart-wrenching. And they have the most incredible crescendos, you know. And his vocal just... I think it's a beautifully produced album, their self-titled album. And they astound me. Like, Glass Vegas, even at the time, I loved it. And now when I go back to it, it still hits me as hard as it did then. And as I say, people tend to think, well, some people have said to me that it's unexpected that I like that album. But once again, Scott's Brogue, you know, such vulnerable lyrics. I think it's in a really, I think it's such a bold record. And it's such an outlier. There was no album surrounding its release that sounded anything like it. And in fact, even after, it didn't cause a big wave of bands that sounded like Las Vegas. It just remained this singular thing. And I think it's so impressive.
I think I think maybe that I guess every time, you know, a lot of the times you'd see James on the cover of the NME, sometimes there'd be football shirts being worn. And maybe that kind of lad culture type football terrace kind of thing, maybe, because he was a pro footballer,
wasn't he? Yeah.
And maybe, I don't know, that they and that, you know, the press would always inflate, like, you know, that, you know, they were, you know, just this absolute like monster band to see live. I've had it happen twice where I've seen a performance on television, maybe three times. Woo Life, I think, when I saw them. But when I first saw the Walkman perform The Rat, I was like, fuck me, what is this? And seeing Geraldine on Jules Holland.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. Yeah.
Something's happening.
And something's happening. And I love that album. Yeah. However, I don't think it's the greatest record, but I think if they released a four-track EP, it'd be the greatest four-track EP ever made.
I mean, like, I'm with you on that. And that's the thing about the I think that's fair to say. There are songs on that album that aren't as good as the others. That's you know, never a truer word spoke of any album, really. But you know, there is on that record, there are ones that are noticeably not as good as the one, I would
wager because the bar set so fucking high.
Because the others are too good. You can't match.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's my own cheating heart that makes me cry. And
anyone that can rip your heart from your chest while singing "Liar Liar Pants on Fire."
Not "Liar Liar Pants on Fire." "Liar Liar 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 Pants on Fire."
Pants on fire.
Yeah, incredible. And this is the this is the happy ending where the bad guy goes down and dies.
Oh,
I absolutely love it.
It's unreal, that record.
Oh, I'm like, so glad you agree. I'm so glad you agree.
Yeah, it's absolutely... That was one of them records. When I got the album, I was going around to like so many of my mates going, listen to this song. And then if they went, wow. Because I can hear elements of like... I grew up like on lots of sort of shoegaze stuff. And I can hear that in there as well.
Oh,
you know,
completely. And especially seeing them live, you know, they're like they're made of stone. They don't, you know, it's just like, I love it. I absolutely love it. Love it.
When I saw your list and I saw that track on there, I was like, oh, I've waited a long time to wait on this podcast.
Oh, good. Yes.
Okay. Final track.
Okay.
A song that many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Right. So, this is another song, I must admit, that really, really hits me every single time I hear it. I've only known it for the past couple of years, though I've been a huge, tremendous fan of the songwriter for many, many years. I believe that the songwriter is generally underappreciated. I don't know why, it's arguable that he's a household name, but I think in lots of circles he isn't sort of delved into very much. I don't know whether that's because, well, he's very well known for one particular song, obviously, and lots of soundtracks and lots of movie scores, and he comes from that world where the instrumentation is very sort of orchestral, and in places it's almost kind of lounge jazzy. And I understand that's actually not my bag, really. So that mm-hmm. can put me off. But when it comes to a piano ballad with original lyrical content attached, he's near enough unmatched in my mind. And so I chose a song that you might not know, that is, as I say, very, very close to me indeed. It's called Wandering Boy, and it's by Randy Newman. It's the last song on his most recent album, Dark Matter. And as I say, I've been a big fan of Randy Newman for many, many years. A friend of mine, in fact, my drummer and collaborator, Stefan, he said that this particular song had been written a long, long time ago and never put on an original album. And it also plays into that theme of parents singing about their kids. Whether or not it's autobiographical, I'm pretty certain it's not. Once again, I mean, Randy Newman is an expert when it comes to writing about or putting himself in the shoes of someone else or building a strong man or something like that.
I'm just realising you didn't choose Daddy's Gone, did
you? No, I didn't. I chose... yeah, exactly. I know, this is the thing. It's the I saw it happen. I saw it happen in real time, and I thought, oh, God. But, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I could have gone for the hat trick there. But, this song is... It's just beautiful. And as soon as I heard it, that album, I bought it when it came out. And there's a few, you know, classic Randy Newman style songs, sort of polemic songs. There's a song about Putin on there, which is very kind of satirical swipe at Putin. And there's another called It's a Jungle Out There, which he'd released before, which is another kind of social critique. But this song is just, it's a simple piano ballad. And it's so heartfelt, and it seems to be from the perspective of a father who, as far as I can make out, has lost a child. And I just weep. There's a couple of songs like that that's maybe a playlist I'd be less inclined to make because I couldn't get through it. It wouldn't be a cheery music on the walk to work. But I think there's no better example of the kind of emotional gut punch Randy Newman can deliver than this song, Wandering Boy. So I would thoroughly recommend it to anyone listening if they haven't heard it before. It's one of those it's not flashy, it's not too clever, it's not, it's not trying to make you... It's not trying to make you cry. It's not one of those. It's certainly not. It's not sentimental in any way. To my mind, anyway. It's very plain, And yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, Hamish, we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast, great. So people can go and listen to that and all the other songs that you've chosen. And obviously, some of your music we'll put on there as well. As we start to sort of come towards the end of 2021, hopefully a much more connected and happy and positive place than the tail end of 2020, what are you looking forward to personally from the rest of the year? And what's going to be happening professionally?
Right, so I'm happy to say that this coming Sunday, I'm going on tour. The band and I are going on tour all over the UK, starting in Sheffield on Sunday. And we're playing an assortment of dates. Birmingham and Glasgow and London and all sorts. Do consult hamishhawk.com for details. But we're all so psyched to be playing. It's the ticket sales seems to, I've been told, are going very, very well indeed. And if the past few gigs we've done are anything to go by, we did a gig at Live at Leeds at the Brudenell, which was, you know, I can't even put into words how important that was for us. It was an absolutely staggering feeling to be on a stage like that. And we'd we also did a couple of dates in Rotterdam, as well as a gig in Cardiff. And the welcome we had at those four gigs was just astounding. So if the success of those gigs is anything to go by, I cannot wait to leave for the tour on Sunday. So that's the first thing. It's looking like, well, I say this with my fingers crossed, it's looking like we may well get some recording done as well before the end of the year is out. Not necessarily an entire album's worth in one sitting, but as I say, it's a sign of things to come if we get some recording done, which is great. And just as you say, hopefully a more connected year. It's been tough for everybody, and it's that, you know, it's that isolation that's been the hardest. And I think, you know, we've spoken about getting back to normal and the new normal and what that is exactly going to look like. But I have hopes that next year is just going to be, let's say, the best of the three, as it were.
Hopefully.
So I am, we're delighted to be heading out on tour. And I'm delighted to have opportunities like this to talk to people like yourself.
Hamish, it's been an absolute joy. like I say, when I saw the list come over, I was like, this is going to be a great chat. you need to come on and do a top
five
on the other podcast as well. We'll make that happen as well.
Anytime, I'm there.
Have a wonderful tour. And if people want to keep up to speed with what's happening on the tour and that, social media, you're on all the usual platforms?
Absolutely, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. I'm there.
Wonderful. Well, if it's all right with you, we'll tag you in that when this comes
Certainly,
out.
Certainly, yeah, no problem.
Top man. Hamish, thanks again,
Not
mate.
Not at all, man. My pleasure.
Boom, there you go. We had a lovely old natter even after we pressed stop. That's a good sign of a podcast. You know, when he sent over Glass Vegas, that track, I thought, do you know what, we're going to get on. And I'll speak on behalf of myself. I felt like we got on really well. There was a good old natter and a nice flow there. And what an absolute top lad. And go check out the show, The Seabright Arms. And if you've not heard Hamish's music, then get yourself on Spotify and have a little listen, because it's well ace. Trust me. I wouldn't lie to you. I'm back next time. In the meantime, like I said at the beginning, go check out the back catalogue. Because there's some ace natters to be listened to. As well as that, you can support the podcast on a thing called Patreon. And it's patreon.com/offthebeatentrack. That gives you access to another couple of hundred episodes that have never been released. Video episodes, radio shows, all sorts of stuff. So, your one-stop shop for all of this. offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time. In the meantime, just be bloody nice to each other. And I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.